Welcome to The Unconventional Path, entrepreneurship and innovation stories and ideas. Hello, I'm Bala Musitz.
And I'm Mike Wasserman.
Hey, Mike. Today's guest on the podcast is Andy Binns. You know, he recently co-wrote a book titled Corporate Explorer, How Corporations Beat Startups at the Innovation Game. We had a fascinating conversation about innovation and entrepreneurship, both in large corporations and in startups.
Bala, you know, this is a topic that you and I love talking about, and we both taught about this and experienced it as in our startups and our corporate careers. And we've had lots of great corporations over the last, I don't know, what, 3 or 4 years plus we've been doing this? More than that, like six years. But it's been a long time, Bala, right?
Yes.
And we've had lots of great conversations about this stuff, about what leads to success and failure in organizations of all size. Small, big, for-profit, not-for-profit, government, we've talked about it all. And it really does come down to these things that are related to being able to innovate. And it's leadership. We've talked about culture and creativity and managing change. We've talked about technology change. We've talked about social change. But it all comes down to how can you respond to changes in your environment and how can you be innovative to provide value to your customers? So given that this is one of our favorite topics, I was really excited when you told me about Andy Binns and his book and I checked it out. And there's lots of interesting stuff. So I guess rather than blather and give all the good stuff away, Bala, what do you think we get right to it?
Sounds good. Let's get right to the interview. Hello, listeners. Today we have Andy Binns on the show. He is co-founder of Change Logic and a corporate innovation guru. So welcome to the show, Andy.
Hey, thank you, Bala. I appreciate that. I like the term guru. That makes me sound extraordinarily smart, I feel.
Yes, it is a good word, isn't it? Very good word. So let me ask you a question. If you're at a social gathering, so not a business-related gathering, but a social gathering, and you get introduced to somebody, And after the introduction, they say to you, Andy, really nice to meet you. What do you do? How do you answer that question?
I say I advise large corporations on how they innovate and change.
And then when you say that, typically what happens? Do they walk away or do they want to know more?
I'm afraid a lot walk away. No, you know, I've had everything from, then perhaps you read my book. And the person asking it knows an awful lot about the topic to a lot of stories. Because the thing is that anybody who's worked for an organization, actually of any size, you know, knows that there is this question of how do we learn to do new things?
Yeah.
How do we get after stuff that is changing in our world? And how do we convert that into, you know, either opportunity or defense, right? And very often, you know, the larger we are, the more we feel the need to play defense.
Sure.
In our business. So usually I get great stories.
Well, that's good.
So that's a lot of what happens.
So, you know, when I hear the words large corporation and innovation, at least in my mind, it almost seems like an oxymoron. Those things typically do not go together. So talk to me a little bit about that.
I think that's right. My dad was in the Royal Air Force, and he often used to say that military intelligence is an oxymoron.
Yes. You
know? And corporate innovation, I think you're right, is absolutely right up there. And you know, I think that that is a deserved reputation to a significant degree. It is really hard. And we can talk more about why it's hard. And in the book, Corporate Explorer, we talk about the silent killers of exploration that exist in organizations. But, you know, we open this book with a different lens. And the one we say is Corporate Explorer, How Corporations Beat Startups at the Innovation Game. And you know, let's be honest, they don't beat them every time. They may not win, you know, half the time, but they do beat. And so, and the reason we wanted to point this out is because sometimes we miss that story because it's not the glossy, the shiny object of a new startup. It's actually can look like a business that's been doing well for a long time, continuing to do well, but actually the story under the hood is rather different. And so, and if we can unlock that, then we can deal with some of the other experiences that people have that, that are much more difficult and much more negative.
Yeah. You know, there's lots of great examples in history of companies that have ignored innovation that grew up within their own ranks and yes. led to their demise. I mean, you know, a great yes. one is Kodak, where they actually invented digital That's right. photography.
That's right.
And so what are the barriers that make this really, really challenging for large corporations?
Yeah, and I just want to underline what you just said. It's like really important that we disconnect these topics. Firms do not get disrupted because they don't see it coming. They get disrupted because they don't know what to do with it, right? And they don't know, and they get in their own way. They sort of struggle to move. Kodak, you know, mid-90s, George Fisher, CEO, comes in from Motorola, and he's all over the idea of digital photography. This is his absolute, you know, every moment of his waking day, potentially too much, right? And he attributes his failure, which he calls it that, to cognitive inertia.
Mm.
That a lot of very smart people, well-intentioned people, cannot get into a new way of thinking, that they are locked in a world which conforms to what they've always done, right? And so this sort of power of habit, or some might call it culture.
Yeah.
And culture is, you know, the expected behavior or norms of behavior in a group, right? And that is a strong, powerful influence.
Sure.
Now, culture has a few different sources. One of them is professional identity, right? And, you know, we're both former IBMers, so we have some shared professional identity. But if you go into an insurance company, the power is with actuaries. If you go into a semiconductor company, the power is with electrical engineers. If you go into an advertising agency, it's with the creatives, right? And this professional identity, if an innovation sparks it, runners against it, they will resist, right? Similarly, this concept we call risk aversion, right? Which really is the difficulty that we have with putting at risk what we've already got when the time comes to invest in what we really want.
Yeah.
Right. And it's a sort of this, we need mechanisms to deal with having both and not either or at some level. And then the other part of this story is definitely that people learn to operate in a system which is set up for constant optimization. How do we get better and better and better at what we always do? Somebody calls it dynamic conservatism.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And actually, this is something that can strike a small company just as much as a large, right? It can strike a small team just as much as a large team, because it's about getting into your comfort zone. And the more successful you are, the more well-honed that success system becomes. And so that makes it very, very challenging to break out. And I think that's what Fisher is talking about when he says inertia.
Yeah. Well, you know, the things you've been talking about here for the last minute or so have to do a fair amount with changes in behavior, right? You're asking people to change the way they behave, the way they think. And that's really, really difficult, right? Particularly if, you know, I've been working at a company for 10, 15, 20 years, and it's been going great. And the way I've been behaving, I've been rewarded and everything's great. And now you want me to behave differently, or maybe I need to behave differently because the world has changed. Those are really difficult challenges. So how do we sort of begin to think about that as an organization?
Yeah. And I think begin is the right word, right? Because one of the mistakes that people fall into is trying to change everything too fast. And an alternative is to think of, how do I start small, experiment my way to success, and think of, you know, we in the book Corporate Explorer, we're talking about people who built ultimately multi-billion dollar businesses, but they don't start there. They start in a small way. And these are business incubators, but they're also cultural incubators, right? And so you can't change behavior and then see innovation. You need to do both together. You need to start small, prove it works, involve people in looking at a different way of doing things,
yeah,
so that they learn new practices, and out of that it can start to scale.
Yeah, very nice. So let's talk about the book for a second.
Yeah.
So the title of the book is Corporate Explorer: How Corporations Beat Startups at the Innovation Game. So talk to us a little bit about that. Who's the intended target?
Yeah, what we really want to do is speak to those people in corporations who have ideas, who have areas of opportunity, customer problems they want to solve, and they want to get support to pursue them, or a manager who wants to see more of those people step forward, right, and wants to understand a little bit about what it takes. Because I do believe that, or we do believe, and our research supports, that just as an entrepreneur is the lifeblood of creation of new business ideas, creation of new small businesses, you know, so a corporate explorer is the lifeblood of new ideas, new businesses, new ideas within corporations. It's not different. There's some differences we'll talk about, but essentially these are the people who spark that creative insight, that they see a problem they want to solve, right? And they're going to go after it and make it happen. And so in the book, we talk about Christian Kurtisch at the insurance company in Austria, Unica, right? This is like a $5 billion revenue, 20 million customers firm. And Christian is a middle manager. Essentially, he's running the Hungary business, which is a sizable business, but it's not, you know, the whole corporation by any means. It's quite small. And he sees an opportunity to advocate for a digital business model that really kind of is incendiary to the way of doing insurance today. And this, incidentally, is in a region with very low penetration of digital insurance products. And, you know, by logic, you would say, well, he should take that idea and go find somebody, a venture capitalist, or maybe a friend with a lot of money to help sponsor him to create this new product. But he says, no, I'm going to figure out how to do it inside. And he wants to do it inside because he already has the licenses to sell insurance in all the countries he wants to take the product to. He already has an army of actuaries, and he already has a set of resources. All he needs is the freedom, right, and a little bit of discipline, but the freedom to get it done.
Yeah.
And that's what he secures.
Yeah.
And he gets it. And we tell multiple stories like that, of these people building new businesses, yeah, inside large corporations.
Yeah. Interesting. As you were saying that, I'm thinking about this notion of, you know, I was in the venture business for a while, and, uh-huh, and basically what venture companies do with the money that what companies do with the money that venture capitalists invest in them is they go get actuaries. They go get the licenses. They go get all of those things that the big corporation has already.
Already has.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's exactly what they're doing. They're building out the sales team. They're building out distribution, increasing manufacturing, whatever it is. So there's a lot of advantages, right, that's that a right. large corporation has. And if you took a step back in the perfect world, you'd say they would win all the time.
That's right.
But they don't. So let's talk about some of the challenges that in a large corporation.
Yes, yes. And one of them is, well, why is it that it's so difficult to get hold of those assets, right? And we're back to this notion of silent killers to some degree, and the way power gets distributed in any established, you know, group of people, right? Those who run it and those who have most influence, right? And sometimes those two people are different, right? Sometimes in corporations, the person who has the most influence isn't the person at the top, the person next down, or
that's right,
who has control over a core, you know, asset, depending on the industry. And so you've got to figure out how to win them over. You know, whether it's Christian at Unica, or we talk about Jim Peck at LexisNexis, or there's a story about Balaji Bondili at Deloitte, a big consulting firm. Each of these characters have to build a sort of social network around them, right, to get through these silent killers. And this is where they're different from the entrepreneurs. You know, the entrepreneur can go out and get access to venture capital, but the corporate explorer has got to work inside. And to do that, they need allies, They need people who are willing to do things for them, help out, commit resources, be willing to support them. You need advocates, people who are actually going to speak up, because corporations are full of rumors and bad news, right? Well, you've got to have somebody who's going to say, actually, it turns out that Bella's doing something really great. Let me tell you why, right? And sometimes you need, ambassadors, people who are going to go to talk to the person who has influence and explain it to them objectively, right? And so this sort of influence network that you need to put together around your idea is that key difference between the entrepreneur and the corporate explorer, and it's what allows them to cut through some of those really tough challenges.
Yeah.
The other thing, Bello, I'd say is that the ones who succeed are often really good at teaching senior executives what they don't know.
Right. Interesting.
And some of that teaching has to be done with a lot of humility, and in a way that makes the executives feel like it was their idea all along, or that at least that they played a big role in making the idea successful. Yeah. And so what we find is that these corporate explorers have strong social networks, high humility, and a sort of a patience and a resilience, really, to sustain the effort and to teach people, well, we're going to run experiments. You run an experiment, and you don't know which option is going to work. So we're going to go find out.
Yeah.
Right? And we're going to start small. That's not in the experience of a corporate manager who's run a $1 billion business or a $10 billion business.
Right. Right.
They're running something with spreadsheets and predictable performance, and you manage the operational levers to get an outcome. This is different. This is high uncertainty. This is lots of little tests. And so they've got to be taught about that. And yeah, these corporate explorers figure out how to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, as you're saying that, I'm thinking, in sort of the typical corporate world, if you miss your numbers by a percentage or two, that could be your job. Whereas in this sort of exploratory stage, you can miss your projections or your ideas by a factor of 10.
That's right.
And that still may be good news.
That's right. And of course, the unfairness is that, you could miss it by a factor of, two in the explore, and the same in the core. But in the core, they'll go, oh, well, that was because of all of these things.
Yes.
And they'll know what they are.
Yes.
Whereas the explore, they don't understand.
Yeah.
Right. And so even the same miss can be misinterpreted. And that's why this sort of managing reputation is so key to success.
Yeah. There's lots of examples of people taking technology and leaving companies and then starting something on their own.
Absolutely.
A lot of examples of that.
Yes.
And I remember the first job I had out of grad school was working at General Electric's corporate R&D center. Mm-hmm. And I remember the guy who sat next to me invented, now this is in the 70s, a hot air popcorn popper.
Way.
Right? 1970s.
Yeah.
And I remember we took it, or he took it, and I followed along because I was curious. He took it up the corporate chain to say, hey, look, this is a business idea, right? There's health, health concerns. People, that was the 70s, was sort of the beginning of thinking about our health and all these things. And the response was, there's no way we see that would be a $100 million a year business. And it's got to be at least a $100 million a year business before we even think about it at General Electric, right? Because you're so big. So the some of the advantages you get of being big also sometimes gives you metrics for a new business, which are really challenging, right? I mean, I would love to run a $50 million business making hot air popcorn poppers, right? Yeah. That would be great.
Yeah,
not very interesting to General Electric because they're a much bigger business. So how do do sort of the metrics that people instill on these types of decisions impact all of this?
Yeah. So here's, I'm going to kind of take a different angle actually to what you just said, Bella, a little bit, because I understand your point that it's very difficult to evaluate things which would be smaller revenue. But I do think if I'm a corporate manager, I want to look at an opportunity and say, does this have the scale of opportunity to be worth my time, to be worth our investment? And some of that can be sketched out early on.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not right at the beginning, but it can be sketched early on because you know who the potential customer groups might be, what the amount of money being spent to solve a particular set of problems are today. You know, you can have some way of getting a dimension about it. And if you can't see a path, then potentially the uncertainty is too high for a corporation and it should go into the ecosystem of startups, right? I'm not saying that corporations should do all of this by any means, you know. So I think corporations actually get themselves into trouble by thinking that they can be like a Silicon Valley startup, that they can have lots of ideas and that some of them will turn into great ideas. That's not the way that I would think about this. I think you start by saying, what's our strategic ambition as a firm? So one great example is MasterCard, right? And this like 2010, 2012, Ajay Banga sets the ambition to say, I want to wage a war on cash and I want to convert 85% of transactions that are currently physical cash. I want to turn it into digital transactions and I want to do it in the following areas. Right. And so what he's just done to his organization is he said, here's what we're trying to do. Here's our big ambition. And then I'm going to say, here are the places I'm interested in ideas to realize that ambition. Right. And I'm going to confine my innovation to some hunting zones, some places where I think there's the right opportunity, rather than the highly democratic, let's have lots of ideas coming, which you never have any idea how to filter or manage or sort. Right. And that's one of the reasons why corporate innovation runs into challenges is because they sponsor too many ideas with too few funds, and then they kill them off at some point because they never really committed to them, as opposed to let's be more deliberate, selective, systematic. Still look for ideas, but in more focused ways so that we know that this is something we're going to back.
Yeah. That sounds very, really good. So what you're doing is you're setting up boundary conditions, clear boundary conditions so people understand what the rules are, so to speak, and probably a set of guidelines for rules of engagement and sort of how things will be evaluated. And then, and I mean, I've always viewed that's management's primary job, right? It's to tell people where we're going, right? Kind of the boundary conditions, and then basically get out of the way. And let people go and figure
that's
it out.
That's it. Yeah, I took 250 pages to say that.
Yeah.
But you're right. That's essentially the point. Yeah. Without question. And you know, the large organizations get into over control.
Yes.
Right. And that's one of the big barriers. This is this operationalization, this trying to eliminate risk, eliminate variation, and really. You know, some of this works within the core business as well, but certainly in the explore, set the boundary conditions, say what sorts of problems you want to solve, and then have diversity of thinking, have diversity of action, and give people the space, the separation from the core business to go do that. And honestly, this is again a cultural issue that many organizations are uncomfortable with the need to make decisions about that, right? It's funny, I have the privilege of working with many companies from different countries and cultures. And if I'm in Austria or Germany or Japan or the United States, or the United Kingdom, everybody will tell me the same story. We are very democratic. We don't like, you know, that's the way we are. We Swabians are, or that's the way we are in Japan, or, you know, well, in the Midwest, we don't, you know. It's human beings, right? Human beings like to maximize comfort in a group. We don't like to have discord. And unfortunately, making choices around what you're going to back and what you're not going to back does create some somebody's going to lose. Somebody's great idea is not going to get backed. They're not going to get funded. Sure. And that, unfortunately, is a necessary activity within focusing your investments on the things that you really want to back.
Yeah. So let's say a company decides, okay, we want to move forward with this thing, right? Someone brought forward an idea. They did some preliminary work. It looks like it's scoping out really good. Now the company wants to stand this up and run with it. Do you have thoughts on how they should do that? You know, do they do it internally? Do they spin out a separate business and then buy it back? Or, you know, what's sort of the operational way to sort of do this?
So it depends tremendously on what you want to achieve, right? So if what you're seeking to do is to create a valuable asset that you might be able to sell, then you can look at spin-outs and joint ventures, and you can look at this model that a number of people now have of a lab with entrepreneurs in residence who come in. You know, we've done some work with the Japanese firm NEC, and they have NECX in Silicon Valley, and they invite entrepreneurs in to look at their technologies and say, okay, what kind of business can you create? And then they have a process for working with them on that. That's a perfectly great way of developing a valuable asset. However, if what you want to do is either build growth for the corporation, or you want to acquire new capabilities, right? Then this spin-out notion is a really poor way of getting it done, right? And most of that activity is wasted, right? And is a waste of corporate funds to do. And it, you know, is, you know, really, I think, subject to a lot of innovation tourism, right? People who get involved in running these little startups and accelerators and labs, and, you know, they're having a lot of fun and they like looking at it, but the last thing they want to do is be of consequence of having to, I've got to scale this to $1 billion or $10 billion. No, I don't want to do that, right? If you really want to build the capability, and let's name some of the areas. You know, if you run anything to do with a motor company right now, and you build things around gasoline powered engines, then your business model might be in difficulty. If you run any business that's subject to changes in terms of digital technologies, which means almost everybody, right? Then you've got some significant challenges out there, and some of these things today are extraordinary. Like the non-fungible tokens, right? The NFTs, and they attack anybody whose business has to do with an asset. Right. And so this could come after many smaller businesses as well as a technology, right? It's a different way of authenticating and valuing assets. And so if that's the case, you've got to figure out how to learn what these things mean and how you can participate in an economy that is changing. Because the one thing we know from stories like Kodak is that the world will change. And if we didn't believe that before, COVID certainly taught us that, right?
Right.
So in that situation, I think you've got to keep these things inside. You've got to separate them out organizationally, right? And if it's a really small firm, that could just mean one person. You know, I get that. And don't go hiring people in from the outside to teach you how to do this. Because this is back to the social network problem, they don't know anybody else. And so you'll never be able to tell whether they're any good or not, or whether you should listen to them, because they're an outsider who you don't trust. Even if you've got good intentions, they will be subject to all that cultural rejection. So choose a trusted insider, make them separate, and then move in small increments. Ideate, incubate, and then scale. Lots of small experiments through the incubation process. That's the key. And that is, to be fair, difficult for a corporation that is often used to spending a lot of money on an idea.
Yeah.
You've got to be patient. You know, anybody who's an entrepreneur knows you move in lots of small increments. And there are times when you're, you know, doing every job, right? As an entrepreneur, I set up my company. I did every single job that was out there, and slowly we found other people who would fill in, and things got more stabilized. That's the same with a corporate startup as well, but it's more difficult for them to do because they're used to having an office of a certain size and having their importance in the corporation based on how many direct reports they have or wherever it might be. None of that is relevant to being successful, and they need to learn to push it aside.
Yeah. So, one of the things that I think is sometimes a challenge, and I'd like you to address this a little bit, is, you know, if I start Bela's widget company, I can put a product out with my name on it, and If it's successful, it's great. If it's not successful, it has no real ramifications.
Yeah.
Whereas if we put a large company's name, a brand name on it, right, all of a sudden, you know, well, we can't do that. And they want to have, I can remember when I was at IBM, there were three-ring binders of documents and processes you had to go through before you could put the IBM logo on something, on a product, right?
Yeah.
So how do companies deal with that, right? Because they're very worried that they don't want to put something out in the marketplace.
That's right.
And it doesn't work.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is part of this whole push towards removing variation and ensuring quality.
Yeah. So how do you do the innovation and the iteration, I should say, you know?
Absolutely.
Testing.
And as a part of that commitment to doing experimentation, you've got to accept that some of the standard rules of how you operate the business no longer apply, right? And that you're going to have to make a deliberate decision to give relief on some rules, but not all, because some rules are there, you know, to keep you out of prison and so on. And so you're going to keep some of them. But that's also why you move in small experiments, so that any risks that you might encounter, as you describe, are significantly limited. So, you know, test markets that are well selected, customer groups that are well selected, and so on. And sometimes you might figure out, as we've done with one of our clients, to do something white label, right? That you might build the asset, but you might white label the actual product in the end. So there are different ways of doing it. But it's a real challenge, no question. I mean, one of the other ways is that in a number of markets, because of digital technologies primarily, you find that I'm serving a customer who then sells to another customer. Well, the digital means I can just cut out my existing buyer and go directly. And that creates a lot of challenge, right? Because you may still have an existing business and so on. So, you know, this question of reputation and brand is very challenging. But the other side of it is that brand is what gives you the right to play in new markets. Mm-hmm. Right? One of the stories we tell in Corporate Explorer is of the semiconductor company Analog Devices here in Massachusetts. And they move into a new market for monitoring industrial machines using their sensor technology, but connecting it to the web with analytics and so on, and then bringing back answers about the condition of the machine so you can intervene before it breaks. And there are lots of people trying to do this, loads and loads of startups, but none of them have a brand that's 60 years old, premised on we never retire a product, we're always reliable. And anybody who knows that reputation, well, this is a different experience.
Yes.
So the brand thing can play in another way as well.
Oh, sure.
But you have to move in increments.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things I heard somebody once say, well, when they were debating whether a company should enter into a new business segment or not, they said, well, you know, I would rather be the one to put our legacy business out of business than to have someone else put our legacy business out of business.
Sure.
Right? Because it's going to go out of business at some point.
Whether we like it or
not. So do you want to obsolete your old product, or do you want someone else to obsolete your product?
Yeah. I think that's true. And the reality of many markets is that it's sort of a both and, right? Is that, you know, take semiconductor today, you know, any story we had about, well, you need to be working on innovation because, you know, your market is moving. Well, that's kind of that they can't make enough wafers right now because the world has such a high demand, right? Or at IBM, you know, in the early 2000s, we had this view that the mainframe computer was going away and we had to invest in a bunch of new areas. That's how I got started on all this. Right, is we'd missed a whole bunch of markets. As you say, people had gone off and started businesses with things they had created at IBM, and IBM just wasn't interested in the market. And IBM was like, what are we going to do? And it turns out we did invest in creating new businesses. Some of them turned into multi-billion dollar ones. But then the System 390, or the Z series, as it was called at that point, reinvented itself, lasted another decade, and with great margin. right? So the story is always, well, not always, is the story is often both and.
Yes.
And you've got to learn to do both and. Netflix, I've got to continue to serve those customers who are buying my CDs by mail, and I'm going to move to streaming, right?
Yes.
This both and is really the story. And it requires from anybody managing it a comfort with complexity, a comfort with you know, paradox sometimes,
yeah,
to manage their way through it.
Yeah. So I want to talk about culture a little bit more.
Yeah.
And I want to talk a little bit about sort of, you know, the generation that's coming up, the ones that are, you know, getting out of school now, they're starting to look for jobs, and sort of their expectations, the types of things that they are looking for, I think is drastically different than what I was looking for in the early 70s when I graduated from college.
Yes. Yes.
So how does this play into this whole innovation spectrum?
Totally. Yeah, there's that. And there's also this whole, what they call it, the resignation,
the great resignation. Yeah.
You know, if I'm running a corporation today, I want to think about a wholly different way of setting up how I get things done. Stop trying to have monoliths, start having much more smaller, more speedboat type organizations, highly empowered to get things done. And I'm going to want to bring in some of the practices that work for the digital natives. You know, I want to have agile practices. I want to adopt these sorts of approaches where I'm asking people to bid for projects to be on, right? Which is the kind of options that people who work in software get. I want them to have that sense of optionality and engagement with their futures, because, you know, that's what they're looking for. And I think the other thing that I'm going to want to do is make sure that a good proportion of my investments go with a social and sustainability purpose. I want to be active in how I'm going to leverage my startups towards something that's more than profit, you know, because again, I think that's key, certainly for that generation coming out of university. But I suspect it's also true for those who are in the Great Resignation,
yeah,
who are more in our age group or younger even, you know, and they also are looking for purpose. They're looking for, you know, something where they can express their entrepreneurial ambitions.
Yeah,
that's something that a corporation should be able to meet as well.
Yeah. Well, it's clear that those factors are, as time marches on, will be increasing in importance,
yes,
not decreasing. So yes, embrace it, right?
Yes, exactly. Now's the time to, it's a bit like the innovation story. Now's the time to move, not when you've got a crisis and you can't, and you're really struggling. There's plenty of evidence that larger corporations are struggling on hiring. Actually, this is one of the stories in our book is about, in Corporate Explorer, is about the Corporate Explorer Balaji Bondili at Deloitte. And he observes that, you know, he's been a consultant for many years. He gets involved in the Asian tsunami relief effort 10, 15 years ago. And it's done by crowdsource. And he participates, everybody pooling their expertise into support the relief effort. And years later, he's burned out with consulting. And he says, well, how can we reinvent it? And how can we solve this problem that Deloitte has that nobody with the digital skills wants to come work for us? And he creates this crowd platform so they can bring talent from outside to serve their customers in their consulting business. And of course, it goes crazy during the pandemic.
Yeah,
right?
So yeah,
it scales like nuts, right? Those kinds of models, how do you bring some of that way of doing work into a corporation is the sort of stuff we need to play with.
Yeah. Hey, Andy, this has been fascinating. We've been chatting here for over 35 minutes. I want to wrap this up shortly. So is there anything that I didn't ask you that I should have, or is there anything else you want to share?
I think that the one thing I'd say is that, coming back to your first question about, you know, who do we write this for? This book is about inspiring people to step up and be corporate explorers. When I look at the people in our book, they aren't given the responsibility. They take it, right?
Yes.
That's a really marked point about the people who win in these stories. They take this responsibility and they build the support around them. It's not something you're assigned to do. And so, yes, it's a tough thing to do. And I know I'm challenging many people who have led a corporate innovation life and it didn't work out for them. And I'm saying to those who are in that role now is, you know, don't be a victim, be a leader in this and find a path through, because there is one there and there are some inspiring stories that can show you the way.
Yeah, excellent. Great way to close. I will make sure that there's links in the show notes on to your book and to your firm as well. So I really appreciate you taking the time to be on the show today. Thank you, Andy.
Delighted. Thanks for the invitation, Bella.
Bela, well, that was a really interesting interview. And I love there was some parallels between kind of your career and what Andy was talking about, what he wrote about in his book. What are some of the big takeaways that you were really interested in from your conversation with Andy?
You know, when you sort of look at large corporations, you would think they should win all the time because they have some great advantages, right? They have an existing infrastructure. They have distribution. They have sales organizations. And these are all things that young companies or new companies have to build and start from scratch. And so it's really a challenge. And that's one of the reasons young companies often have to raise outside capital, because to build a distribution network, to build a sales organization, to build a manufacturing or production facility, you know, it takes a lot of capital investment up front before it starts generating returns. So large corporations already have this. And I find that to be, you know, a great advantage to them. Now, their big challenge is, of course, they have an existing business and they need that existing business to generate the revenue so that they can build new products and new businesses in the future. So they want to be careful to make sure they pay sufficient amount of attention to existing businesses, because they need that revenue. And at the same time, they have to walk this tightrope of, you know, I got to look into the future, but at the same time, I need to pay attention to my existing business. And the other challenge, I think, for large corporations, particularly in the Fortune 500, is for them to get interested in something, it needs to be pretty big. It's like back, I think I mentioned this in my conversation with Andy, when I was at GE, it had to be at least $100 million a year business opportunity before they even got interested. Well, I'll tell you, there's a lot of small private corporations that are, you know, generating $40, $50 million a year that are fabulous, but they're not big enough for the really big guys. So there's this kind of threshold you have to get across in a large corporation. And I think that's one of the challenges that they often have. And that's one of the reasons they sort of miss out on these homegrown opportunities, because they're never quite big enough to get across that threshold barrier.
Yeah, I agree. And it was really cool the way Andy framed it and the way you kind of jumped in with some of the examples that you had in your career, which is neat. I also liked how he talked about the importance of culture and in overcoming these cognitive biases or these blinders that people have that inhibit people's willingness to change their thinking and to change their behavior. And you two kind of talked about that a little bit. But we've talked to a lot of different people about organizational culture. How important is culture? What did you take away from talking with Andy, and kind of what's your own experiences with the importance of culture to innovate?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the most important things from my perspective is how are people treated after they try something new that doesn't work out? So in most corporations, you get rewarded for success. So incremental innovation, incremental progress has a high probability of success because it's a small step you're taking. Whereas if you're trying to take a big step or, you know, branch out into a new business, that's high risk. I mean, look, even the best venture companies, you know, somewhere to a third to half of the businesses that they fund go out of business, right? Mm-hmm. Those are the really good venture firms. So if you look at a corporation, they're oftentimes, an existing large corporation, they're oftentimes not set up to deal with, okay, we're going to invest, you know, $10 million and try this thing, and it doesn't work. And then when it doesn't work, you know, what happens to those people, right? Do you Do they get, in essence, put in the penalty box, as sometimes I like to call it, right, for the next 3 or 4 years, and, you know, a bunch of them will leave or whatever? Or do you say, okay, that's a success. What did we learn? What can we apply from this experience so that the next time we do something, we can build on this and make this a learning process? And, you know, that's what the entrepreneurship community does. They stumble and fail a lot, but at the same time, they learn from that. And then they build on those experiences. And I think that's one area that sort of corporations really have not done very well at.
Yeah, I totally agree. And one of the things that struck me as you were talking about this is in Germany, we're a lot more risk averse in general. It's a cultural difference. And of course, there's exceptions in these cultural kind of models are stereotypes, and stereotypes can be bad. But in general, I found this to be kind of a reasonable approximation that on the whole, on the average, people are more risk averse in Germany than they are in the US. Now, we have some really great pockets of kind of startup activity and risk taking, but in general, it's not. And this does impact these great big ideas, right? These frame breaking innovations that you're talking about. And it does really encourage incremental innovation. And we've been a country of incremental innovation. We're, as you know, really good at engineering, really good at building stuff, really good at refining things and making things with a high level of quality. But we've fallen behind in the kind of the great big ideas. But I'll tell you that there's lots of people that work on this in the educational system and consultants and things like this that are getting people to use things like design thinking and lean startup methodologies and things that you and I have taught to get their minds wrapped around. Okay, it's okay to take a risk. It's okay to fail. We don't punish failure. We punish failure if you don't learn, right? You fail multiple times, right? But failing once there's nothing to be ashamed of or embarrassed of. But it takes a long time to make those changes. So I really see the cultural differences in what you're talking about and kind of the upsides and the downsides of this aversion to risk, and that's why there isn't as much venture capital money here as there is in the US, and there aren't as many startups. The startup rates aren't as high here per capita as in the US, but it's changing, it's growing, but it takes time to adapt that culture. And I think organizations face the same challenge. When you're traditionally a risk averse company, you think of the insurance industry, right? They're pretty risk averse. Right. And they're slow to adopt digital platforms, right? There was the example of the insurance, right, startup. Or the insurance company that in Australia that he talked about. It's a risk-averse industry, right? Now, you can contrast that with banking, where they were typically risk-averse, and then deregulation happened, and the whole banking crisis, right, the whole mortgage thing, right, debacle right. happened. You can run into trouble in the other direction. So there's no checks and balances on risk-taking. So I think the path is somewhere in between, I guess, is a long way of saying this, is finding ways to encourage risk, and to reward risk taking even when the risk fails, but you still have to have some guardrails up around, right, what's an acceptable amount of risk to take in any existing organization. You said it great when you were talking about, you know, I'm not slapping the IBM name on anything that its employees come up with, right? There's a big risk there. Right. So what are the guardrails and how can you do? I love the idea of the white labeling and doing kind of these spin outs and things where you're doing skunk works, right? And it doesn't have the company's brand name on it, but you can still experiment. So I don't know. What was your, I blathered for a long time. I'm sorry, but it really struck me. So how do you get to this position? How do you get your employees to be more willing to take risk and managers to reward that risk, but also to stay within the guardrails? Is there a middle ground?
Well, I hope there is. You know, I think that, what you just talked about is sort of one approach that a lot of companies are using. They're trying to find that middle ground for themselves. Where is it? Where is this middle ground for us? And, you know, that varies from company to company. It varies from the industry you're in. It sort of varies to the tone that the leadership and the management team sets for what's rewarded, what's not rewarded. But, you know, another sort of interesting approach, and you know, there's a couple of companies that do this, they don't worry about developing their own products. They acquire. So their approach is sort of, we're not worried about developing it inside. What we're going to do is we're going to keep our eyes on the lookout for things that are interesting that maybe, you know, maybe a competitor, a small competitor today, but it could be turned into a big competitor in the future. So we're going to buy them now and we're going to integrate them and incorporate them. And that's what they've decided to focus on. So they've decided to focus the way that we're going to grow our business is by acquiring companies and then integrating them into our business. So there's a couple different approaches here. And I think, you know, there's no right or wrong one. They all have their challenges, right? A lot of, we all know that the studies have shown that most mergers and acquisitions, a large percentage of them fail, right? And here again, you go back to this notion that I think large companies have a challenge accepting that things don't work out, right? They're so driven by it's got to work out, drives you down that road of incremental innovation, where even in the mergers and acquisition business, half of them fail. Half the mergers and acquisitions don't do anywhere near as what was expected. Like I said earlier, most venture capital firms, you know, somewhere between 30 to 50%, you know, the average venture capital firm, 50% of their companies go out of business. The really good ones, only 30% of their companies go out of business, right? So I think that's just part of the territory that comes along with trying new stuff. And as one person told it to me early in my career, that's the reason we call it research. You do it over and over again. You're researching, right? So anyway, that's sort of my two cents on it, Mike. Yeah.
I love that, Bill. I've never heard that. The research, you search again and again. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it was one of the guys I worked with in IBM mentioned that to me, I think.
It also leads to unethical behavior when there's these pressure for results, right? That's what a lot of the banking stuff did, right? You've got, okay, we took a risk. It didn't work. There's all this pressure. So you cook the books,
right?
Right. Or you do something illegal. So yeah, this openness is really important to failure. And I don't quite know how to put my finger on it, but I do think that talking about hiring talent, right? Hiring the right people and giving them the right incentives is pretty important. That bringing new people into the organization, I think you were talking about kind of, okay, after you've worked there for a long time, this is the way we've done it. We're successful. So this is the way we should keep doing it. And that infusion of new ideas, I think, is important every so often for a company. It helps people realize how to change, that they need to change, and then get them to do things. And I love the methodology that Andy gave about how to work with somebody. He was using it in terms of an executive, but I think it works at any level. It works with me with high school students and college students, right? That you've got to teach with humility, right? And then run things like experiments. And I love his description of how to kind of, that's a just a nice change management 101 kind of thing. It's just be humble and let people think it's their idea, right? And run with it. And you don't have to, in the beginning, make people put a lot of skin in the game and take a lot of risk if you can frame it as a short-term experiment,
right?
And see if it works and let them see the results for themselves. And then they'll be more willing to commit, right?
Right.
And make some change.
Right. Sounds good, Mike.
That was great. Yeah. All right. What do you think? I blathered a long time. I'm sorry. Do you think it's time to wrap it up?
Yeah, I think we should wrap this one up, Mike.
All right. Well, listeners, thanks for joining us today. We hope you found this episode and this interview with Andy Binns interesting and thought-provoking. If you have questions about what we discussed, as always, please feel free to get in touch with us. Our email is bela.and.mike@gmail.com.
And hey, please do follow the podcast if you haven't already. Just hit that follow button on your favorite podcasting application. So until next time, signing off from upstate New York. See you soon, Mike.
Sounds great, Bela. And from over here in actually sunny and warm Münster, Germany, we'll see you soon.